The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Science Weekly dedicated to... Do I even have to say it? Yes, the sun is out, our maps of Brazil have been pinned to the wall, and the 2014 World Cup is underway. England and all the teams from northerly climes face not only the footballing skill of our southern cousins, but also the very particular weather conditions in Brazil. More pointedly, the first game we face against Italy in the Amazonian city Manaus. So how can science help? According to my special guest today, Professor Greg White, it can be critical in winning any sport at the highest level. Greg came into the Guardian studios to run through all those technical questions about acclimatization and how athletes perform in hot and humid conditions. It's sobering stuff if you're an England fan, but nonetheless a fascinating insight into our understanding of physiology and sport.
And the opening game of the 2014 FIFA World Cup.
So I'm Professor Greg White. I'm a professor of applied sport and exercise science, and I've got a relatively unusual background. I was an Olympian at modern pentathlon, which is five events: running, swimming, shooting, fencing, and show jumping. And spent 12 years as an international athlete. And then, alongside that, there was no money at the time, so you either worked or you trained or you studied, and I studied, and so came through that route as an undergraduate, postgrad, and then into a PhD. And then I became the director of research for the British Olympic Association. And actually, from an environmental perspective, I looked after the preparation of five Olympic teams for preparation in various environments, particularly the heat. For example, Athens in 2004, I headed up the acclimatization strategy for that. And now, really, I work in a whole range of different areas, but particularly with environmental stresses in ultra-endurance activity, and both the challenges but also the solutions to make sure that they don't become a problem over time.
So we were going to talk about what challenges our England football team faces when they go out to Brazil for the World Cup. And tell us about the environment they'll be in and what are the issues they're going to be facing.
It's a tough place to be. It's an interesting one, really, because what we've got is almost the... It's almost a perfect storm of environmental factors, because match one versus Italy, 6 p.m. kickoff in Manaus, the capital, the Amazonian capital. And really what you've got is you've got a whole host of things. So pre-game, you've got things like travel fatigue, you've got jet lag, which they're still currently trying to get over. They've flown into Miami to try and reduce that. But there is, you know, we all know when we travel those such long distances that there is that effect. But it's actually the environmental conditions which are the key factor, the heat. At that time of day, we're talking somewhere in the region of 30 to 32 degrees centigrade. Add on top of that the key factor, and that is humidity. And it's going to be running at in excess of 80%.
Now, how does that compare to humidity here, typically?
It's an interesting one, because in the UK, actually in the summer, you can get some days where it's incredibly humid. The UK notoriously is humid during the summer. We don't have that sort of arid environment that you get in a desert-like environment. So actually, you know, most of us have experienced what high humidity feels like. But think about it, you know, 32 degrees, 80% humidity is probably the worst day you can remember in the UK.
Right.
Add on top of that, you've now got to run, sprint, walk, jog for 90 minutes in an attempt to win a football match against one of the premier teams in the world. And importantly, I think, a team as well in Italy who actually are relatively accustomed to heat. They know what it's like to play in heat. And you should never discount that, because strategy is one of the crucial elements of performance in very tough environments. You have to know how to control your play. And for England, I think one of the key areas is the fact that they play an incredibly physical game. And so therefore, a very running game, a very physical game, you're going to suffer a lot more than those free-flowing movement passing games that some of the Europeans and the South Americans play.
What does it actually do to you, though, being in the heat, being in the humid conditions? I mean, you know, the things that come to mind are obviously dehydration. But what is happening to you? Is that the only thing you need to worry about? Do you just need to worry about drinking more water or what?
Do you know, the key thing is core temperature. It's about the body temperature. Now, we are what's called homeotherms. And what that means is we operate around a very narrow band of temperatures. So as we're sat here now, body temperature about 37 degrees centigrade. We don't have to go very much above that before we become what's called hypothermic. And in fact, it's only 3 degrees centigrade. So as soon as we move to 40 degrees centigrade, we tend to talk about being hypothermic. Only 2 degrees above that, at 42 degrees centigrade, actually what we do is we start to denature protein. We start to break down protein. Muscle starts to break down. So there's a very narrow band around which we operate. So what we are trying to do, what we are very, very good at, is control that core temperature. And there's a whole host of ways that we do that. But the most important is through sweating, but critically evaporative sweat loss. So it's not sweating per se that's the key. It's the evaporation of that sweat from the skin. Now that really
is actually taking the heat with it.
Exactly. Yeah. And physicists will understand that fully. But that evaporation is crucial. The problem with humid environments is that because the water vapor in the air is so high, you don't get evaporation. And we recognize that as beading of sweat and it rolls off. But of course, what that's doing, when it rolls off, it's not affecting thermoregulation, doesn't cool the body. And so that's really what the key is. And of course, the downstream cascade of that is dehydration, because we're losing huge amounts of sweat. Once we become critically dehydrated, we can no longer sweat. We actually close down the sweat capability. And then at that point, temperature starts to rise and rise and rise, and we're in this really negative spiral.
You've probably been in the situation yourself as a pentathlete where you've been performing at your limits in hot conditions, humid conditions. What does it feel like when you're in those extreme conditions?
There's sort of two elements to it, I think. Well, one is performance and one is health. There are times when it does become a little bit scary. If you talk to athletes about it, they'll talk about their head boiling. and sometimes in really hot environments, when you're really pushing yourself to the limit, because why does exercise matter? Well, exercise, we're actually producing heat. We're very inefficient. Around about 3/4 of the energy we produce is dissipated as heat. And that's why we heat up and start to sweat very rapidly when we exercise. So in competition, the higher the intensity of the activity, the greater the amount of heat production. And of course, when you're at the elite level, you are really pushing your body to the absolute limit. And it can be quite a scary place from a health perspective, because you can really start to feel your body warming up. From a performance perspective, two elements really. One is that you get an ensuing lethargy, is that you always feel tired. We know what that's like, feeling tired in the heat. Because what it's doing as well is it's reducing the function of the muscles. So our ability, our power production, our force production starts to fall. Our sprint speed starts to fall. But importantly...
Is that to protect you so you don't produce any more heat? So you kind of, your body stops you doing it.
There's two ways to think about it. Interesting is that we talk much about this thing called the central governor, where what's happening is the brain is intervening and saying, look, we are getting too hot, we have to slow down. Equally, at the periphery in the muscle itself, oxidative enzymes, which is what we use in order to turn things like glycogen in the muscle into energy, into ATP or ATP resynthesis. Those enzymes are critically associated with heat. As the cell gets too hot, they don't function as well. We don't produce as much energy. And so as well as controlling it centrally, peripherally it's being controlled as well. But of course, the other key factor for football, for example, is cognitive function. Mm. Is that what we start to see is we start to see that we start making bad choices. Our ability to make those decisions is impaired. And so therefore, making sure we're in the right position on the pitch, making sure that the weight of the pass is the right weight of the pass to the right person, reading the game, all of those things will start to deteriorate as we start to heat up.
Right, God. So they're gonna be up against it. I mean, I was looking at some FIFA figures before you came in, and Group D, England's group, is the only one that has three teams in the top 10 ranking. Yeah. So you have Uruguay ranked 7th, Italy ranked 9th, England is 10th, and then Costa Rica is further down. Among those teams, are they all better acclimatized or all better to deal with the conditions in Brazil than England?
Yes. I mean, it's a simple. A lot of people talking about Costa Rica, you know, well, they're not in the top 10. They're outside of it. If anybody in that tournament knows how to play in humidity, Costa Rica is the team. You know, and I think never discount the importance of experience. I mean, it's absolutely critical because it's not about the first 45 minutes. It's about the second 45 minutes. You know, it really is about that period of time where we see the greatest number of goals scored, the last 20 minutes, the last 10 minutes. And it's at that point where, you know, classically what we see with good teams versus poor teams is that most of the goals are scored late on because the bad teams are tired. They're just fatigued. Mm-hmm. Well, environment will do exactly the same thing, particularly for a team like England, because they're so physical, because they play a running game. That will mean that the first half is going to be a very tough half. What they do at half time is absolutely crucial to how they perform in the second half. Whereas these other teams who are accustomed to it, they're experienced in it, they know how to play in it, that's going to be a key factor in the performance overall.
How far before the tournament have they flown over? How much time have they given themselves to acclimatise? And does that really work?
Acclimatisation is absolutely fundamental. I mean, that's the one key tool that they've got in their toolkit. I mean, there's a whole host of things that we can do to lessen the impact. I mean, again, the important thing here is that we can't eliminate it. Mm. You know, as good as we are as scientists, we can't eliminate the effect, but we can dampen it. And certainly acclimatisation is the key thing. You know, what's going on with acclimatisation? Again, one of two areas. One is tactically, that they're learning how to play in the heat. And, you know, we saw that in the two-all draw, what the heat can do to them. And they would have learned an awful lot from that game, just in terms of tactically. Not only them, but also Roy and the rest of the support team. But the other side of it is actually things like being able to thermoregulate a lot better, is that they're acclimatizing to that. Paradoxically almost, but what happens with people who are acclimatized, they sweat more. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a good thing, because the more you sweat, the more able you are to thermoregulate. But, of course, the more you sweat, the more you dehydrate.
Right.
So making sure you've got the strategy for rehydration right is absolutely crucial as well. So there's lots of things that we're learning. Acclimatization is crucial. Has England done enough? It is a really interesting question. You know, to some critics, they would say no, they simply haven't been out there long enough, number one. Number two is that they've gone to the wrong place. They've gone to Florida.
And how long? When did they go out to Florida?
Just at the weekend. So because they played Friday night and then flew out. Now, for me, that is long enough.
Right.
But I guess what the critics are saying is actually that Florida isn't Manaus. You know, it isn't the environment they're going to face. It's a much tougher environment.
They're in Florida, do they have to be doing training for hours a day and really pushing themselves in that environment to get this acclimatization of their physiology to kick in?
No is the answer to that. I mean, that's the interesting one. And a huge amount of work that we've done with Olympians has sort of led us to the understanding that invariably you're talking something like 90 minutes a day in the environment is enough. And with higher intensity activity, you can potentially shorten that period of time, maybe down to something like 75 minutes, even down to 60 minutes, maybe less dependent on the intensity. And of course, what you have to think about as well is also about recovery. Is that what you don't want to do is take these guys, you know, a week before the most important game of some of their lives and fatigue them dramatically on a continued basis by exposing them to it all the time. So what they will be doing is they'll be doing all of their very hard, heavy sessions in as hot an environment as they can possibly get, but then spend the rest of the day actually in air-conditioned environments, relaxing and recovering.
Do the younger guys acclimatise more easily than the older guys? I'm trying to think what the age range is on the team, and it must be from, like, I don't know, I'm not sure, but they go up to about 32, I think,
yeah, 18 to 33, like, yeah.
Right,
yep.
Okay.
Yep. The answer to that is no. I mean, okay. But you make a very important point, and that is the heterogeneity of response. I mean, it's a very, very different amongst different individual players. So the concept that you can just have one strategy and you're going to apply that to the entire team is erroneous. Effectively, what you've got to do is you've got to individualize the approach. And I certainly know that some of the stuff that they're doing out there is that they're measuring sweat osmolality. So they're measuring the salt content of sweat in order to try and make a bespoke fluid, rehydration fluid, for each individual player. So, you know, it really does come down to these nuances of differences, which can be profound, and making sure that what you're doing is taking each individual player and giving them the best opportunity to fully acclimatise.
Are they going to be making those rehydration fluids out there? That's something they'll be able to mix up out there, will they?
Yeah. I mean, the wonders of modern technology. You know, they can we can measure sweat in the field. These fantastic little sweat patches, which you actually sweat into the patch. You can draw off that fluid. You can measure what the concentration of salts are in that, and then what you can do is bespoke make fluids which replicate the salt loss, the salt makeup. There's some really incredible stuff that has evolved in recent years with science, and importantly sports medicine as well, which has actually enhanced the quality of support that we can give athletes.
What are the danger signs we should be looking for on the 14th when England go out against Italy? Is it apart from people dragging their legs and looking very wet in the second half? I mean, what sort of things should we be, you know, looking for us thinking, oh, they're struggling, apart from being 4-0 down?
Yeah, well, there is that. And do you know what? I think there's probably two classic areas. One is mistakes, is that with fatigue come mistakes. And I think if you start to see a growing number of mistakes, then invariably what that's telling you is what's going on underneath the bonnet. You know, that tells you whether they're fatigued or
not.
Does
that affect the brighter ones less? Like, if they're just more intelligent, they're not quite so. they can lose more before they start getting it wrong. Yeah, you never know.
But, well, I tell you what it does. It plays into the experienced one's hands without any shadow of doubt.
Sure.
Because what they do is they work less hard. You know, they won't be the one chasing down every single ball. You know, they'd be much more selective in the work that they're doing. And so, there is a value. Again, the critics have been saying about taking the older players out there. Actually, there's a value in that, because how you deal with the environment is going to be crucial to how you actually cope with it.
What are the sort of things they can do before, apart from acclimatization, getting their bodies used to the environment they're playing in? Is there anything else they can do that involves sort of technology or anything pre-match?
Yeah. I mean, one of the key things that I know they're looking at is what we call pre-cooling. And that is to actually, what we can do, the rate of heating of the body is pretty much set, because it's dependent upon the environment and the exercise intensity. So we can't stop the body temperature rising, but what we can do is if we can reduce the starting body temperature, then what we can do is we start from a lower point, so it takes longer to get to that critical temperature point. And we do that in a whole host of ways, and we've used it very successfully with sports like British cycling in a variety of different environments. British hockey, we've used it with, do you know what, ubiquitously across the board. And what we're doing is we're basically cooling them down in order to offset the heat issues. That's pre-game.
Are you taking them down to 37 or below 37? Because, well, presumably you're going to run into, you've got to be careful about going below their sort of homeostatic, you know, temperature.
You certainly don't want them hypothermic, and that's down to 35 degrees. But, right. I mean, they may be bordering down. But again, critically, what we're talking about here is core body temperature. What we have to be very careful of is not to change muscle temperature. So, you know, the sort of things, obviously the key muscle groups for the football players are obviously the legs.
Yeah.
And so much of the cooling will go on in the upper body to try and bring the core, the central body temperature down without profoundly affecting the muscle temperature.
How do you do it?
I mean, a whole host of ways. Probably one of the best ways is actually just a what's called an ice vest. So they wear a vest which is very cold.
Yeah.
And what that's doing is effectively stripping heat very rapidly from the upper body. Other ways that we've used, so with cycling, for example, we actually immerse the hands and forearms in water, in cold water. And of course, with the brachial artery, there's a big blood flow going through. And obviously what's happening is that basically you're not just cooling that area. The blood is being cooled, and that's taking back centrally and cooling globally. So they can do it through arm and hand cooling. They can do it through vests. They're probably going to be, I mean, you can use cold showers and you can use cold baths, but obviously they tend to affect the working musculature as well. So I would say we're talking vests and arm and wrist cooling.
Okay. So apart from pre-cooling, they've got 45 minutes. Do they then do a bit more cooling in the half-time break? And what are the sort of other adaptations they can do of their actual game, apart from, you just said, the kind of experience issue of not chasing down every ball? Is there something they'll be looking at to actually strategically play differently?
I think that's definitely the way. And certainly if you look at the warm-up games, what Roy Hodgson's doing is he's actually looking at the broad base of talent that he has. Because I think, you know, you have to act very quickly. When you've got fatiguing players, you have to act very quickly. Now, the great thing about the group games is there's no penalty shootout. So, you know, we laugh about that, but that's really quite important, because when you're making a substitution, you're not actually worried about who is going to take a penalty. So you know, potentially you could take off some of your key players. If your key player is working incredibly hard for 60 minutes and they are so fatigued that they can't go on, you can afford to make that substitution. So I think there are tactical ways in which you can play, and that's going to be really crucial. There's no doubt about it, Roy Hodgson and England FA have thought about that, because if you have a look at the distribution of players amongst the squad, you know, the number of midfielders, you know, the midfielders are running in excess of 11 kilometres in a game. You know, that's a huge distance to be running in that environment. So if you've got an opportunity to bring on another great midfielder, then actually there's a real value to that, because they're coming on fresh, they're coming on cooled, and they can make a massive impact on the game, particularly mid-second half. So strategically there's that. I think, you know, much of what's going on the pitch is that players have to be much more intelligent about how they play. So the nature of their game will change. And that's not an easy thing to do, to change culturally what you do. But outside of that, half-time becomes really important. I mean, half-time is crucial, as we well know. Whenever you watch football, it's the second half that really matters. And actually, what they do at half-time is critical. They're going to come off very hot. They've got a very short period of time to make any definable difference to how they're going to perform in the second half. And making sure that they intervene rapidly and effectively is going to be crucial.
And that'll be fluids, like you were talking about, bespoke fluids, and maybe cooling as well?
Definitely cooling. I think definitely cooling, definitely fluids. I think it'll be about actually making sure they can dissipate the heat as quickly as they possibly can when they come off. It's about the kit that they wear, and it's about changing that kit. Lots of different ways in which they can adapt it, but there's no doubt about it, half-time's crucial.
What about the environment for these other games? You've got the Manaus game, you talked about the first one, where you're looking at 30C, topping 30C and 80% humidity. The other games against Uruguay, Costa Rica, are they in as bad places or worse? Is there worse?
I think that's the point. I mean, they're starting in the worst place.
Right.
I mean, for me, I think the first game is absolutely crucial. Number one, it's Italy. Number two, it's the toughest place they're going to play, without any shadow of doubt. And also what you have to imagine is that in terms of this acclimatization ability, in terms of the experience, they're going to grow in that continually. Once they arrive in Brazil, that's going to get improve and improve and get better and better. So they're going to be much more acclimatized, much more technically skilled in that environment, strategically skilled in that environment when they move to their latter games. You know, there's much talk about altitude. One of the games is at 3,000 feet. It doesn't worry me at all. Really don't get any changes in physiology at that type of altitude. There may be some impact, but it's going to be marginal. So without any shadow of doubt, game one is the key game, both in terms of the table itself, but also their performance. And the hope is that it will get easier and they will get better in two and three.
What do you reckon the chances are of getting out the groups?
Wow. That's a tough. Honestly, it's going to be very, very tough. I mean, I think they're in a really tough group. The opponents that they have are, you know, two of them are ranked above them. The one that's ranked below them is used to playing in that environment. It's going to be a very, very tough ask to get out of this group stages.
More people are going to be going out to Brazil who aren't particularly sporty. That's the fans, and a lot of them are going to be in this environment, sitting around. They're probably not the most sporty people themselves, and they're going to be drinking a lot. What's it going to be like for them?
Horrendous. I mean, you know, it's a really interesting question. You know, a much debate has ensued, you know, with Qatar 2022 about the environment, and really, you know, the focus of attention should be on the crowd. You know, the players have got a bespoke team of people around them supporting them. They've come out and they've acclimatized. They will go to the stadium in an air-conditioned bus. They will be in air-conditioned changing rooms. They will come out to play. They'll be pre-called, etc. You know, the list goes on.
Yeah.
The fans will have traveled on an unconditioned air-conditioned bus for hours on end, sweating profusely. They will then top up their hydration with a dehydrant in alcohol, which causes diuresis and makes them even further dehydrated. They may not be the fittest. They may have underlying disease. You know, and the bottom line is that invariably what you find is that the events, the cardiac events that take place, but the heart is one of the key things that we're worried about, occur in the crowd.
Yeah.
That's where they occur, because what's happening is they're dehydrated, they're hypothermic, they're incredibly stressed, and they've performed a huge amount of physical activity, which to many of them will be a new experience. And that is the perfect storm for a cardiac event. So, you know, looking after those guys is
important. Skip just come back in 2018
or take it, you know what? If you're going to drink, that's fine. But, you know, drink water alongside it. Take every opportunity to rest. And you know, really, honestly, they really need to look after themselves. And I think much of the messaging for the fan is about think about health, because it really is. You don't want to go to the World Cup for that experience of a lifetime and you know, come home.
So it's, I mean, although it's tedious to say it for football fans, I mean, it's drinking in moderation, topping up with something, water, and I suppose something for salt loss.
I mean, do you know what? I mean, there's so many fluids out there now, yeah. which are isotonic, you know, electrolyte fluids. Mm. And, you know, there's so much on the market out there. But fundamentally, actually, you know what? Water's good. And water is definitely better than beer when it comes to rehydration. But certainly, it is about just thinking about that. But also things like, you know, wear appropriate clothing. Don't allow yourself to overheat. Don't stand in the sun for long periods of time. Mm. Remember that sunburn reduces your ability to thermoregulate. And so therefore, the more sunburn you get, the less able you are to actually thermoregulate. So that's going to create a problem for you as well. So standing out in the midday sun without SPF on is a really bad idea.
Their hangovers are going to be bad as well.
Because, yeah, I mean, hangovers are fundamentally driven by dehydration. It's the beautiful cocktail.
We've got on to what this sort of sports medicine really means for the rest of us, you know, those of us who aren't top athletes and sports people. I mean, what else is your sort of science in this area doing to tell us about fitness and for the rest of us in terms of how important it is for health?
You know, the great thing is that elite sport is really a shop window, and it's aspirational. Mm. But I think particularly something like football really is, you know, the reason why kids play in the park on a Saturday morning is because they watch their premiership team or their team on television and they're inspired to go out and actually do something, which is a great thing. But obviously, what's important within that is that what it's doing is promoting physical activity. And we know that physical activity is absolutely fundamental to quality of life. We know that physical activity reduces the incidence of cancer, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, as well as improving psychological factors. So it improves self-esteem, reduces depression. And then also, sort of globally wrapping that is the sociological effect of participating in physical activity. You know, we know it as a team athlete that when you come together with the team, it's wonderfully enriching. Mm. But equally, you know, if you're just going for a run or you've entered the local 5K, all those sort of things make a profound difference to quality of life. And I think what we learn, both in terms of, I mean, what you have to imagine is within elite sport, we're now wrapping an athlete in anything up to sort of 17 specialists, from physiologist to biomechanist to nutritionist to psychologist. And all of those are effectively learning about performance, learning about physical activity. And that drip feeds across the spectrum into people who are not only completely inactive, but also a lot of the work that I do is actually in diseased populations. Mm. So physical activity in people with cancer, with heart disease, with pulmonary disease. And what we know is that across the board, physical activity is wholly beneficial to quality of life.
Is that message getting across to these people?
No is the answer to that. It's a very simple answer to it. I think it's a very difficult one. I think invariably what we are is society is driven by big industry, and the messaging that we receive is fundamentally driven by big industry. Well, there is no big industry for exercise.
So big industry meaning technical devices, medical devices, drugs.
Yep, pharmaceutical industry, but even things like the food industry, transport industry. You know, why walk when I can buy a fantastic car? You know, and so what tends to happen is that physical activity message tends to get lost. I think we're starting to see an awful lot more of it now.
Because there's no money in it.
Well, precisely. I mean, you know, there's no money in it, so therefore there's no lobby group.
Right.
You know, who's going to pay for the adverts? Who's going to pay to lobby government to make big changes? You know, so it's a very difficult sphere. But I think what we're beginning to understand is that actually physical activity not only saves lives, but it also saves a huge amount of money. And so I think we are starting to see government shifting its position on physical activity and exercise. Only this week, an all-party parliamentary group on public health came out to say that the tsunami of premature deaths associated with physical inactivity is simply unacceptable. So the message is starting to get through, but frankly, we've still got an awful long way to go to actually shift people from inactivity to activity.
Great. Greg, it's fantastic to have you in. Really fascinating to hear all this stuff. And it's depressing for England's prospects, I think, in the World Cup. But what can we do about that? I mean, it's all set in stone now. Thanks for coming in.
Absolute pleasure.
To find out more about Greg's work in sport, just go to his website. That's gregwhite.com. We'll have a link on the blog for this podcast. And don't forget, for all the best coverage of the World Cup, go to theguardian.com/football. That's all we have for you this week. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. Enjoy the tournament and come on, England! Is that you telling me to shout it louder, or is that you joining the party? No, good.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.